Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
I hope you didn't mind me putting you into that new breed of cat out in Hollywood, because there is a new thing out there, and I presume you're pleased to be a part of it.
Well, I don't know. If that is a new breed, and if I'm a part of it, that's a flattering description that you put on. I don't live too much in Hollywood these days, so. But I guess people still think of
well, that's
movie
the new thing.
History.
Yeah, yeah, that's the new thing. Meaning, nobody lives there anymore.
Yeah, maybe that's why there's more real people. Huh?
We all work there, and we all make our living in motion pictures. But it's changed. I tell you, Van Johnson was here last week. Now Here's a guy who goes back to the old days when he was part of that big MGM stable of stars. But things aren't that way anymore. People are taking an active part in more than just the acting, and you're doing it yourself now, directing, for instance.
Well, Van Johnson, there's a famous story about him that he did quite a few bit parts in the studio, and they couldn't get him going, and finally one time they did a test by accident, of which they didn't let him wear any makeup or anything, and all the freckles popped through, and kind of talking about realism, which you were just bringing up, and all of a sudden they said, hey, that's the guy, you know, and he became a big hit.
Did Clint Eastwood always want to be an actor?
No, I never was interested in it at all. I never really knew what I wanted to do. I'd gotten out of the service and was going to college on the GI Bill, and I had a chance to go under contract to university. In those days, the studios all had large contract groups, and I had a chance to go under contract to Universal for a very small thing and a very small price, a wage, and study acting. So I decided I'd try it for 6 months. Well, you never try it for 6 months. It takes you over completely.
And it didn't take long to take over. It was like the proverbial bug that bites you? And
yeah, it does. You get wrapped up in it, and then when you get to the point where you get enough success that you are doing films, then the films kind of grab you.
Of course, the big thing in your life, I'm sure, and in the life of any young actor nowadays, is to get a TV series where you're seen by, you know, literally millions of people, and Rawhide was it for you.
TV series is the fastest way to get, you know, exposure to the public. I mean, I guess so many people watch television, plus the fact, if you get a hit. Fortunately, Rawhide was a hit show, and it ran quite a while.
Was it a hit right away? Was Rawhide an immediate
Yeah, it was
success?
A hit immediately. In fact, it was a show that almost didn't go on. They had canceled it. It was supposed to go on in September, and they'd set it back, and finally it went on as a mid-season replacement. And they had 12 of them filmed, and they didn't know what they were going to do with them, and it was rumors that were our shows were out and all that sort of thing. And it went on, and about the second month it was on, it was up way high in the top 10.
That was it.
Doing well, so we hung out for a while.
Was the work as hard as you expected it to be? Was it perhaps a little bit easier?
It was hard. But it's never hard if you enjoy doing something.
You enjoyed it right from the start.
And there were times it got hard, let's say that,
well, you're,
over the years. But,
you're a guy who doesn't like to use doubles, I understand.
Well, that part's fun. I mean, everybody, you know, as a kid, you're always frustrated jumping off. You imagine yourself doing all these things. So it's fun. You get to live different existence.
You enjoyed doing the rough and tough stuff, though. It didn't bother you at all.
No, that's the fun part. That's the easy part. The only hard part is trying to fill time each week, the sort of unsung hero are the writers, story editors, and so forth, who have to fill an hour's show every week, and if you don't have the material, if there isn't any substance there, then you have to fill it anyway.
It is tempting to sit here and discuss with Clint Eastwood things like the Rawhide television series, and frankly, we are going to talk about movies like For a Few Dollars More and Fistful of Dollars and Good, Bad, and the Ugly. But before we get to those, because it is a fascinating story, you are kind of wrapped up now in something else. Well, you've wrapped it up, and now you're trying to sell it to America, to put it bluntly, and that's a new movie. But there's more than a passing interest for Clint Eastwood, isn't there?
Well, yeah, this is a film that I had the story on for about 4 years ago. I've had it for about 4 years, off and on. I had the story under option, and then the writer, I was in Europe doing Where Eagles Dare, and the writer said she had a chance to sell it to Universal for a good price, so I said, go ahead, sell it. They had it for about a year, year and a half, nothing happened with it, and I came back, I signed a deal to do several pictures for Universal, and I took it off the shelf and tried to develop it.
This is what interested you about the story to begin with, Clint?
Well, I always loved suspense films and the entertainment value of suspense films, but what I liked about this one is the suspense element is not it's not a monster film or any particular distortion that way. It's just it's a subject that can happen. I mean, the whole smothering type of relationship can happen, does happen to almost everybody to different degrees, you know.
Even to disc jockeys.
Right, and this is a story of a disc jockey who gets, who has somebody who requests. I think every disc jockey has a groups that constantly request tunes, and he finally meets her, and the relationship turns into sort of a psychotic one.
It's a fascinating concept to begin with, especially to those of us in the business.
Yeah, the people in disc jockeydom or broadcasting or whatever. What do you call yourselves?
Yeah,
broadcasters.
Broadcasters, I guess, or communicators. Somebody came up with a word because the business has changed somewhat. Some people don't like the word disc jockey because, frankly,
that's like calling an actor a play actor.
Yeah, probably, because we do more. Like, we sit and talk. Now, we're not going to play any records with the exception of Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, maybe, for an hour. And yet this morning I played a whole lot of records. I guess we're communicators, but there are still disc jockeys, and the disc jockey of Play Misty for me is just that. I mean, he plays records, although he does more.
Right, well, it's small towns. In a small town, I think disc jockeys become almost as well known as anybody. You know, everybody knows everybody anyway, and everybody listens to the show. And I kind of, I took it and filmed it in Carmel, California, because I knew a disc jockey there, and he kind of was this type of guy. Everybody knew him. The script was originally written to be done in a city like Los Angeles, or could be done here, anywhere.
And describe though what he does, because I think this is interesting. The type of disc jockey, the time of the evening that he's on, and the
type
he's
of a night disc jockey, and he comes on after the sort of daytime rhythm and blues guy, and he plays jazz or rock or whatever, but he also does poetry and everything.
He's
I understand.
Cool. And he reads and recites poetry. And he gets a particular request from a particular listener, and then this is the beginning of
he gets a romantic image going for this one listener, and when he meets the girl, he informs her that he's got other involvements in life, but that doesn't seem to stop anything.
We don't want to tell him too much more, because as Clint told you, it is a suspenseful movie.
Right, it's basically a suspense film, and being a disc jockey is just his profession. He could have been anything else except the whole introduction to the story of getting into it and how he gets involved through the request scene, you know.
One of the things that I'm sure Clint has been asked before, and you're going to have to listen to this time and time again from interviewers, and you mentioned the fact that you knew a disc jockey in Carmel, but, you know, the obvious question is, you know, is this guy based on a real person, somebody that somebody knows somewhere who is on late at night and reads poetry? And
well, I think the writer designed that character because there are people who've done this. There have been disc jockeys in the past. I guess there are still some that do that.
But it's not based on any particular individual, is it?
The female in the piece is based on a real individual, sort of. I mean, and the story isn't exactly that story, but it's the female in the show did some of the deeds.
Let's get to the other part of this. In addition to picking up the story and starring in Play Misty for Me, which is Clint's newest film. By the way, it's from Universal Studios, and it opens here in Chicago at the end of the week. But you have more than a passing interest because you decided to direct this one.
Yeah, well, I directed it, Roy, because I just had the story so long, I decided I better just try it myself, put it down the way I saw it. Normally, you'd hire a director, somebody you agreed with or you respected their talents, and you'd go ahead that way. But this one, I had the cinematographer too. Partly, was responsible. He kind of talked me into. We worked on several shows together, and he kind of said, "You know, look, you have it that strong in your mind. Why don't you put it down?"
Have you ever directed before?
I've directed segments of films. I did a short subject on Don Siegel, and I've done second unit on films.
Second unit is what?
Well, that's when the director is involved in one sequence, and you go out and shoot sequences that, so you can double up. You're shooting one sequence on one side of town, he's shooting in the other. And
did you do this by request or because you kind of pushed for it?
Well, I did this film I made after Misty, Dirty Harry. I have, one the director planned on me doing, and another one he came down with 103 temperature one night, so I took over for a few days.
What goes through an actor's mind? Now, here's a guy like our guest today, Clint Eastwood. He doesn't start out in life to be an actor, but the bug hits him and he likes it. But what goes on in your mind when suddenly you are faced with all of this responsibility of making whatever's going to happen happen, and it's your baby? Isn't it kind of frightening?
Yeah, it is frightening. And it causes anxieties as you're doing it. You think, is this something, halfway through? It's the same with performing, though. Halfway through a picture, you always wonder if you're doing the right thing.
But if you're performing, the director can say, "Hey, cut," and then he can tell you what to do.
Oh, I see. You're getting to the part where, you mean, how do you judge your
right.
performance, the third eye? Well, I used a video replay technique.
Oh?
Yeah, and I for most of the film. And that way you can go back into and look at a monitor and see the scene back on television.
And how many times do you remember, percentage-wise, were you maybe a little bit unhappy, or you said, "Gee, we better do this again. I'm not too
happy." Performance-wise, you can usually feel it, and you can see it when you're in, and you can feel if the ensemble's working, if all the machinery's going. The only time most of the time, it was because there'd be, a zoom shot, there'd be a fish, the operator would miss it, or the composition
That's
didn't
technical.
Look right. Yeah, mostly for technical is where it worked out.
I'm trying to think of fellas.
Occasionally you'd kind of scrutinize your own stuff,
I was kind of trying to think of guys who have been successful directing and acting, and, the first one that comes to mind is Jerry Lewis, who is,
mm-hmm.
who just seems to, everything he touches turns to gold.
Mm-hmm.
Have there been many other actors, though, who have successfully acted and directed?
There haven't been too many I know of. The most famous one, I suppose, was Orson Welles years ago. The French film buffs think that the best one was Robert Montgomery in a picture called Ride the Pink Horse.
Oh, yeah.
That was... That's the Europeans. They feel that was the best direction and acting combined.
What was the one he did where he put the camera on his,
That was Lady in the Lake. Was that in the lake?
Lady in the Lake or something like that, where the camera was the
individual,
the character,
yeah.
the main.
And you only saw him once in the picture in a reflection in the mirror.
Right, which I thought was fascinating to look at once anyway.
Well, I think he directed that too, but Ride the Pink Horse was considered really big stuff as far as within... kind of film buffs, at least in France and England.
So really, you're kind of charting a perilous course here, in a sense.
Yeah, it's taking on a lot of responsibility, and a critic asked me the other day, "Is it? Don't you feel it's kind of risky?" I don't feel it's risky, because if the film didn't work, I could have, I can always... Or go back to working with substantial directors,
Go back to Italy and make a movie.
Yeah.
Make yourself a few million. Back in July of this year, there was a cover story on Life magazine. The world's favorite movie star is, no kidding, Clint Eastwood. Did you have to spend a couple of hours with a Life reporter for this story, or did they pick this up from other sources?
No, actually, I spent about a week. They came out when I was filming this film, Dirty Harry, in San Francisco, and they just followed around for a week.
For a guy who has made as many motion pictures, successful motion pictures, and who gets a cover story on Life magazine, Clint Eastwood, as we have found out for the first half hour, is about as unassuming a kind of guy as you'd ever have a chance to meet. You don't act like an actor. No, wait a minute. Let me rephrase that. You act like an actor on the screen, but you are very quiet and unassuming. Have you always been this way?
I've just never been an extrovert, I guess.
I mean, you've been married for...
I'm a really lousy interview, especially for a column like that magazine. That's why they had to stay with me for a week.
To get enough material.
They could have probably gotten in a half hour on anybody else.
No, but you've been married to the same woman for 17 or 18 years?
Going on 18.
I said, which is kind of refreshing.
Well, it's kind of different in Hollywood, that's for sure.
Is she in the movie industry at all?
No, she never has been. Mm-hmm. She's an aficionado, but she's not... hasn't been involved actively.
I said before that we had something in common, and that's because Clint's son's name is Kyle, and of our six sons, our number five son is Kyle.
Yeah.
Any special reason? Now, did you pick out Kyle? I got to look in it. You know, friends, you don't mind a little personal thing here today. We got to find out why we named our sons Kyle.
Mine was named Kyle after Kyle wrote the football player. She just always thought that that was a great name. We've never met the man, but she thought that was a fabulous name. I found out that Frank Gifford named his kid Kyle for the same
whole mess of them around.
The same reason, but it seemed to go well with Eastwood, I think. And actually, her first choice was Clint Eastwood III, and I had been Junior, and I had kind of gone through that route. I just didn't see. I felt the kid should always have his own name, his own identity. And
great, Junior, Sonny, or Little Clint, maybe.
Yeah, Sonny,
really?
Little Clint, Junior, and. It's confusing for a few years until you get your
own. Our Kyle was only because all of our guys' names begin with K, and when we got down to number five, we were beginning to, and then somebody, I guess we have quite a few of our sons play football, and we're kind of football fans, and I think thought of Kyle Rope, too.
Yeah, could be,
but it's
subconsciously.
It's your dog that I want to talk about, Symphony Sid. Now, come on, I didn't think anybody in the world, except a few ex-Easterners like myself, knew who Symphony Sid was. For those uninitiated, Symphony Sid was probably one of the first jazz disc jockeys.
Yeah.
I used to do jazz concerts with Symphony Sid and Charlie Ventura.
Yeah, he was big time. Didn't Lester Young or somebody write a tune called Jumpin' with Symphony Sid,
which was one of George Shearing's big hits.
Yeah, Shearing, yeah. And they even did lyrics to it later on, and somebody else did kind of a bop-type lyrics to it.
Right.
Yeah, I remember that. That was a fabulous era.
How did the dog get to be
Symphony Sid? The dog was Sidney, just named Sidney, and I don't know why I named him Sidney. He just looked like a Sidney to me. I mean,
what kind of a dog is he?
A Basset Hound.
He looks like Sidney.
Right? Yeah, he just it looked like the right kind of name for him. And then we shortened it up and called him Sid, and Symphony Sid, and you know, what else?
Are you a jazz buff at all when it comes to music?
Yeah, I've always been a jazz buff. I've been kind of going back to it lately. I kind of got away from it for a while, but I went to Monterey Jazz Festival this year, and that was great fun. And all of a sudden, I got interested in, you know, got the old Oscar Peterson records out and everything.
Whatever happened to Osk? Who was at Monterey this year?
Well, Peterson was there.
Great.
And he was greater than ever. And Dizzy Gillespie, that whole group, Brubeck, Mulligan. Fabulous thing.
Super.
Anybody with a tinge of nostalgia for jazz, you'd have gone crazy.
Oh, it would have been fantastic. Because I kind of grew up on that, I guess. We'd travel, like if Stan Kenton was playing within 90 miles of my house, you know, we'd drive just to hear him.
Yeah, it was
like
big
that.
Stuff in California, too. People would drive, used to play in Balboa, and people would go all the way down from San Francisco and Oakland just to spend a weekend there catching kids.
They call it the famous Balboa bandwagon. That's what they called it.
Yeah.
Now, of course, is your home in Monterey, Clint?
Yeah, I live in Carmel, California now.
Well, that's where Errol Garner made one of his great albums.
Yeah, the Concert by the Sea.
Right. Now, let's get back a little bit, as long as we're
Jimmy
back.
Lyons, in fact, produced that, the same guy who produces the Monterey Jazz Fest, and he was the West Coast Symphony Sid. He was a jazz jockey in San Francisco when I was very young.
It's it's funny how this whole thing ties up, because Errol Garner's recording of Misty And I think perhaps once the movie gets around, once it opens here in Chicago later this week and people go to see it and hear Errol's recording of Misty, it might be a revival of a great jazz song. And the fact that you come from Carmel, and that's where Errol made one of his most successful albums, this whole thing sort of ties together.
Yeah, that wasn't planned to come out that way, but it did. I don't know.
Now, was the song Misty by Errol Garner, was this always in the screenplay and the story?
Yeah, the writer had written, it was always called Play Misty for me. Studio wanted to change the title. Everybody wanted to change the title because they felt that the nature of the picture being a suspense picture, they felt it should have a psychotic type title like The Screamer or something like that. But I thought that just made it sound like a cheap movie to me, and hopefully it wasn't that. So we resisted that. And, you know, you never know if you're right or not. I always feel that the public has much more intelligence than the movie studios think they do anyway. I mean,
thank you.
They find out, they're going to find out what it's about, and I think they deserve a better, I think they deserve to be played across to and not.
Well, you have been the unfortunate recipient of the bad selling of what was not a bad movie. You went through this yourself, didn't you?
Yeah, it can, you know, that is part of the reason I guess we had so many arguments on the present film, is that I did a film that was intended to be exactly as it came out, and going into it is an unusual type film called The Beguiled, and it was sold as a Western, and this consequently alienated people who wanted to go see a Western and wouldn't like the type of picture Beguiled is. Were turned off by it, and the people who would normally like The Beguiled were turned off by the advertising, never went anyway. So we had some pretty good, some markets it was did quite well, others it was kind of spotty. In France right now it's just, you know, going through the roof, so it depends on where you are, but it wasn't those kind of unanimous type deals where it would go well in each town.
What's with you in Europe? You know, between the success of Beguiled in France and the success of the movies in Italy, you have much to thank Europe for.
Well, the movies in Italy, the $3 films, started out there, but they were kind of unanimous films. Right. In every country they did equally as well, from, you know, Hong Kong to South America, even down in India and places like that where they don't sell too many American flicks.
Was there any indication when you first went over to Italy to make the films that, you know, anything like this would happen? Was there any feeling early in the filming of the dollar films?
I felt it had an opportunity to be as... I felt there was maybe an audience for that style as I was making it, but there's so many things that go into making a film. You never know, for instance, that you played The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. You never know that kind of music's going to go into it. Especially me living here and making a film over there. You never know how the photography's turning out as you're doing it. In European films, you look at the dailies, they're in black and white, pretty cruddy looking.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to really get a feeling of the film unless you've worked with the director before. And on that first picture, I thought, you know, who knows? Then when I saw it, I was, you know, pound for pound, or dollar for dollar, for what the picture cost, I thought it was a very pleasant surprise.
Of course, I think that was the amazing thing, was the cost of the movies. The first one, what was it, a couple $100,000
yeah.
budget?
Mm-hmm.
Which in America is, what, impossible?
Oh, you couldn't have made it here for that, or near that.
You could make a short subject for a couple $100,000. And then they turn out to make, what, $4 million?
They're getting a little more lenient now, I think, people, because of the conditions. At that time, you couldn't have made anything. But now unions and management and everybody are realizing that you're killing the industry by the padding, you know, having eight guys doing one job in there.
Now, as a director,
they begin to realize that things are making concessions now, so it's working better.
As a director, you are becoming much more aware of things like that, aren't you?
Yeah, well, you have to be aware of that. And filming Play Misty for me, we did it all in the Carmel region, 100%, interiors, exteriors.
All on location.
And that's the way we worked in Europe, and that's the way I like to continue working, because there's no spirit. In a movie studio, there's a lack of spirit that happens. When everybody gets on a soundstage, it's they're all looking for their chairs. When you're on location, everybody's picking up something and running.
When a fellow becomes, or a gal, becomes successful in show business, they are continually written about. And I wonder sometimes if they're as happy about what is written as they should be. For instance, in the Life cover story, I would imagine you were generally happy with what Life had to say, weren't you, Clint?
Sure. I thought it was fine. They misquoted my age and a couple, you know, tacked on a few years. But other than that, you know...
Do you want to correct that right now
for all the ladies listening in?
Doesn't make any difference.
It didn't make any difference. I thought it was a very flattering article.
But here's something else now. In the paper this morning, Norma Lee Browning has a column in the Tribune, and she writes usually about Hollywood and Hollywood people. Mm. And I've interviewed Norma Lee, and this is her job to find out what's going on in Hollywood. But she says in the paper this morning that you won't direct another... Yeah, she says here, he told us months ago he will never again direct himself in a movie. And she even has never in italics. I don't know whether that means that you really said it or she can't remember.
I think...
I don't know. Why did they put it in?
I think... I don't recall making that statement, but, you know...
Did you ever talk to Norma Lee?
I doubt it. I doubt if I said that, at least about that particular topic. I've talked to her in the past. But I probably... I said that there was a difficult job, but it's best to direct and act in a film, and maybe it was a good idea not to do it again. Whether those things get interpreted differently, you know, people like to, I mean, writers kind of move them around to where they remembered them at the time, and maybe even justifiably forget exactly how you worded the discussion.
I tell you why I bring up the subject of your directorial prowess.
Because it's one of those rumor has it articles. I think that particular quote is one of those rumor has it type things anyway, yeah. Which are kind of out of the woods, you know, like rumor has it the guy is in an argument with a truck driver. I mean, who knows?
Who knows? No, but the reason I wanted to bring it up, because I know some people whose opinion I value greatly, people who are film buffs, who are very excited, not only about your acting performance and about Misty for Me, but think you did a whale of a job directing it.
Well, we've had very good luck so far with, you know, we're having our good luck with notices at the present time, which is pleasing. That isn't the end result as far as box office goes, but it's flattering to one's ego to think that the effort is working out.
Now, you mentioned box office, and let's face it, movies is a business. To be success, a motion picture has got to make money. People have got to pay to see it. Mm-hmm. Now, what goes through your mind in this current kind of upheaval that we're in the motion picture business? You want to be successful, and yet, what kind of movies do you think you want to make?
Well, I feel that the only thing that an actor has... you know, the gratification can be is to entertain, is to go away, have the people go away entertained, and that is shown by how many people are in the theaters. If the theater's empty, that means something's gone wrong. And I don't want to make any pictures for empty theaters, hopefully. And I don't know, it's... I think every time a picture comes out that is bad... badly done or bad taste, or and a guy goes and sees it, you lose that guy for another 6 months or so. I mean, he doesn't, maybe not younger audiences who may see a lot of films, they're exposed to more, but say the average working guy, if he goes to a bad flick and doesn't go away entertained at all, you lose him for a while. He's stuck with the tube for a while. You know?
What's a good movie? What do you like? What do you find entertaining?
Oh, I like all kinds of films. I love good adventure films. I love a film like Summer of 42. I thought that was a nicely done film, and I think it's a stage in life, a stage everybody goes through. It's fun to watch it created that well on the screen.
Do you enjoy some of the foreign films that we eventually
get
to see in America?
I thought The Investigation of a Citizen Above Suspicion was a good film. Conformist, they have some nice ones out lately.
Good. Clint Eastwood came to town to talk about Misty for Me. He stars in it. He directed it. And what is your next venture now that this is in the can and has opening in Chicago this week? There are other things to do, aren't there?
Yeah, Roy, I've got another film that will be out at Christmas time called Dirty Harry. And... Then I'm starting a Western November 1st called Joe Kidd.
Do you mind getting back into the Western bag?
No, not at all. I've been away from it for a while. I was kind of looking forward to going back.
Were you ever worried, like maybe during Rawhide or while you were making the films in Italy, that you would never get out of that? Was this of concern at all?
Well, you know, everybody keeps talking about typecasting all the time. I think actors go through a period in their life where they're starving and they think, just get me in anything. I don't care what it is. I want to do well. And
want to work.
Work, and then I worry about getting untyped later. And that's what happened, even though I went to Europe and made the dollar pictures. They were still a complete departure from the character I played on the television show.
Right.
So that helped take me one direction, and the success of those films allowed me to go further in another direction.
It's been fun to talk to you today. I've enjoyed it.
Thanks, Roy. I enjoyed it.
Oh, now look, ordinarily we don't do this on WGN, but we have a special request to play today. Somebody named Evelyn. And if you want to find out what a real sweet little lady Evelyn is, Clint won't tell you today, but he would invite you to go see Play Misty for Me, and they can find out for themselves. Right?
Right.